Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Before we start today's podcast with Stoya, I wanted to give a few notes about it. I really enjoyed my conversation with her. I had a lot of fun and learned a bunch of new things. But just a heads up that this episode is very explicit. So if that's not your thing, please enjoy one of the other 167 episodes of the Psychology Podcast. If you do listen to this episode, though, and I really hope you do, please stick around all the way to the end, as the conversation smooths out really nicely. Also, during the course of the episode, there was a bit of a static noise that we were hearing on our end, but our awesome audio engineer was able to remove most of it. So I also wanted to give you that context so you aren't confused when you hear us talking about the static noise. Now, without further ado, let's jump into my chat with Stoya. So today it's great to have Stoya on the podcast. Stoya has been working with sexuality for over a decade. Her writing credits include The New York Times, The Guardian, and Playboy. Her first book of essays, Philosophy, Pussycats, and Porn, is available through Not Occult Media, and her experimental porn project lives at zerospaces.com. Stoya, great to chat with you today.
Hi. I have absolutely zero problems with that biography.
Yay!
Congratulations.
That's awesome. You're so fascinating. You have so many facets to you, right?
Yes. Like Walt Whitman said, I contain multitudes.
Yeah. By the way, that's one of my favorite quotes, but I also feel like some people contain more multitudes than others. Do you agree with that?
I think some people contain more multitudes and others contain deeper multitudes.
Ooh. That's interesting.
Were I to have to categorize myself one or the other, I would definitely say superficial diversity.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm not agreeing with that, but I'm saying I see your point about the difference between the two. No, I wasn't like, yeah, totally. You're totally superficial, Stoya.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Superficial diversity. That's the place
for it. No, I'm saying, yeah, that's a really interesting distinction. Yeah. So there's depth versus breadth. What women should have been more nuanced?
I don't know if it's anyone's place to critique Walt Whitman.
Yeah. Certainly not my place.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, my voice is cracked there. I won't edit that out. I won't edit that out. Okay, so I have all these questions for you today. I want to start off with, the question, what is porn? Like, how do you define that? Let's just like jump into the deep end immediately.
All right, so my big thing is like, what is porn? Because the United States government says, I know it when I see it. Stripe, the payment processor. Their terms of service define porn as video.
Right.
Visa is effectively the arbiter of American morality because they decide what they will and will not process payments for. Now, I haven't been able to get Visa on the phone, but I want to know what Visa's definition of porn is because they have so much power. Like, they literally dictate what is and is not obscene by saying what they will and will not process payments for. So I'm really curious about their definition of obscenity and of pornography. And I do this book club every month, which focuses on erotic literature. And every time I go, hey, was this porn? And some people think it was porn and other people think it wasn't porn. So I don't feel like I have like an actual working definition. To me, pornography is media made with the intent of sexual arousal or titillation.
Okay.
And so that's a start. Anything. But that means to me, Cosmo's list of 101 sex tips to blow his mind makes Cosmo pornographic.
Right. Right. So intention matters. And then within the domain of porn, we have different. Can we make different value judgments? Is there good porn? Is there bad porn? I know you've tried to sort that out.
Right now, we collectively make a lot of value judgments. We say, this didn't get me off, so it's bad porn.
Mm.
And that's most of the value judgments that are made about porn. Or we say, I'm an evangelical Christian, and this freaked me out. Therefore, it's porn. But these are all very individual, subjective definitions, not anything done with like intellectual rigor, you know?
Yeah. And also that kind of definition is very like personally subjective. I think some other people might think of, oh, that porn is bad because maybe has negative consequences on the actor, or maybe like some people would, you know, people have different perceptions of what they're seeing, right? Some people might watch a certain video and be like, this is bad because it's violent, you know, or there's aggression here. And whereas someone else looking at the same video might be like, oh, I love this. I'm totally into this. Do you know what I mean?
Well, are women who've been sexually assaulted and use faux rape-themed imagery to process that?
Right.
So, like, you can't take, I mean, you could, but I don't think it's a good idea to take that away from that person.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I don't feel like I'm not going to like say I have the answers, but you can see how some people categorize. I know that because I did prepare and I read an interview saying you don't like talking about your thoughts on feminist porn. But this is my like nerdy way of getting at it. You know, some people might make this like false dichotomy, like feminist porn is all good and non-feminist porn now is all bad. And you might see that kind of black and white way of thinking. And what are your thoughts on that?
American living under hypercapitalism. I won't fuck with any porn that can't pay my full rate. And that immediately takes most feminist porn companies out of the running.
Yeah, you've talked about the structural barriers, right? That cause women trouble in the porn industry. So you see, obviously, capitalism is a major structural barrier.
So before we get into that, there's like a higher level issue.
Okay.
Can there be feminism under capitalism?
What do you think?
Under the conditions of capitalism at all, can there be real feminism? And I don't think so. I think capitalism causes a lot of situations that are bad for women. For instance, women get paid less on average. And the defense is, well, they go off to have a baby. And I'm like, guys, if we just like valued people based on what they do in the world instead of how many dollars they can generate, then we wouldn't be valuing women less because of their propensity to do the childbearing thing, contributing to the next wave of population, which like, I'm pretty invested in someone being young and spry enough to like give me my injections when I'm 90, you know?
All right. So feminism, can it exist under capitalism? it's an interesting point, and I'm trying to think of what would, like, I always try to think, like, what would a counterpoint be? Like, can you have, like, feminists given you any counterpoints to that?
Well, capitalists have.
Well, sure.
What's wrong with the free market? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, it's, you know, except for the fact that it's crushing millions of people slowly to extremely poverty-ridden death. So, like, you know, aside from that, I don't really know what else is wrong with capitalism. Can we get the blood-sucking monster off my face before we worry about what I'd like there instead? Thanks.
Right.
I got to tell you, I don't have time for liberal feminists. I'm fucking sick of dealing with liberal feminists. I don't care what liberal feminists have to say to me about anything anymore because I was an open ear for a decade. And they didn't make me feel good and they didn't help the situation. So I'm just not really, like, I don't know what their deal is now. I don't care to know. Maybe in another 5 years, I'll poke my head in and be like, hey, LibFems, what are you up to lately? Maybe our goals align now, but I'm not planning on it.
So liberal feminism. So, I mean, you're not, are you conservative? Are you, like, what is a liberal, like, there's far left and there's all sorts of gradations. So,
well, let's see. I have 5 psychiatric labels. I'm also a cis woman and a pornographer. And I feel like that's enough labels for me. Mm. If really pressed, I will say I'm a conservative anarchist. But, like, wow. That's only because I want you to go away and stop pushing me to label myself further.
Wow. That would be a label I've never heard.
Right. There's me and my honorary brother. That's it.
All right.
We're the only ones.
Okay. Well,
it's just like, hey, like, look, I'm down with dismantling capitalism. I do feel like actually burning it to the ground is going to cause a lot more suffering than it really needs to. So, like, let's do this piecemeal, but build towards a more autonomous society.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So aren't most liberal feminists I know would agree with that, though, right?
Most liberal feminists I've met want to know how I feel about the fact that my job perpetuates rape culture.
Oh, I see. I see.
They actually say things like that to my face. They say, this woman is clearly dissociated because she describes mechanical injury in doctory language and she's too much of a dumb whore to do that. They didn't literally say it that way, but, like, that was the message. And I'm like, what else am I supposed to call it when I get bonked in the cervix and now my pussy hurts because of a mechanical thing? I would call that a mechanical injury. So do you understand
that?
Yeah.
So you're dealing with a lot of judgment. You're dealing with a lot of inferences.
Yeah. And, like, I don't want your husband cheating on me with my porno. I want him coming to you honestly and saying, I like to watch porno, and then all that being okay. It's not my fault that your boyfriend uses my porno to do things that you're not happy with. Like, you need to deal with that. You need to deal with your own relationship, not go blaming an entire industry.
Yeah. So you wrote this interesting article relating to this about this wedding that you were at. It was
that was some old shit from Vice.
Yeah.
That was a million years ago. I know they milk it like I'm still writing for them, but it's been a very long time.
But the overall point there still stands about the pitfalls of heteronormity or normativity and monogamy and sort of the judgment. And so that was just an example of some place you were where people were.
But that wasn't liberal feminists. That was misguided older Americans who just aren't exposed to much that scandalizes them. So they didn't know how to digest the fact of a porn star being at someone's wedding. But that's very different from the liberal feminist problem. They weren't actively trying to be shitty to me. They were just having, like, an issue processing something they'd never run across before.
Sure. And you even said in that article, you said filled with conservative people. So I wasn't linking it to the political view, but I was just trying to link it to the fact that, you know, there was a lot of judgment. And you made this point. You said, to me, the thing we describe as cheating is lack of respect for boundaries. So you're saying, like, let's focus on the things that really matter, that transcend, you know, what your lifestyle is sexually, right?
Yeah. I mean, of course, now, like, poly's a thing that's had, like, reality TV shows about it. And, like, the world has changed. We have multiple sex workers with regular columns in respectable publications. Not like, oh, one of us gets an op-ed every once in a while, but, like, actual column inches in printed media. Like, that's legit. So the world is sort of a very different place than it was when I was writing for Vice. And one of the things that's different is I have too much self-respect to accept $50 an article.
Right. Me too, by the way.
Yeah, I
know. Yeah, I mean, as a science writer, I feel like science writers get even less than porn stars writing. I don't know. This is definitely one of the most unique interviews I've had on the Psychology Podcast in my 4-year history. So thanks for
welcome.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for I mean, I love every unique experience I have on this podcast. I like going with it. All right. Why does our collective conception of quote normal sex leave out a whole lot of sexual preferences that quote normal people have?
American Puritanism, read Foucault's History of Sexuality. It explains it all.
Well, for our listeners who haven't read that necessarily.
So America was founded by people who looked at England and went, you guys just aren't uptight enough for us. And then they came here and they set up shop and became the dominant culture through like kicking out or negotiating out all of the other cultures. And this super like evangelical-esque Christian stuff is just baked into our culture. So anything that isn't for the purpose of procreation, whether we're religious or not, we're living in a world, like in a country specifically, that shames things that aren't for procreation. We're like, oh my God, anal, that's so weird. You can't make a baby that way. Ew. Or like, feet, gross. I'm so freaked out by the foot guy. Dan Savage, what do I do? Oh, I keep the foot guy, because if I don't keep the foot guy, I'm going to end up with a diaper fetishist. And like, what the fuck is that, Dan Savage? Literally, what are you doing? You're shaming people with diaper fetishes. They're people too.
Did he do that? Did he write a column about that?
Yeah. Oh,
I missed
like
that column.
Every time someone's like, I met this guy who's got a foot fetish. He's like, be nice to the foot fetish guy or you'll get a diaper fetishist next and you'll deserve it.
Yikes.
He's a tiny bit less blunt, but like only the tiniest bit. And like, why do we freak out about all these things that are like actually pretty common? And it's because people are afraid to talk about their actually pretty common things, because there's always someone waiting in the wings to go, ew, what's wrong with you? Ew, gross, you're a pervert. And that doesn't feel good. So people stop being open and honest about their quirks.
Mm.
And we just, you know, plus the ban on speaking about sexuality in graphic detail in most outlets, like Slate, I can't use the word fuck. I have a whole sex advice column. It's about sex. I can't use the word fuck.
Where's that? You mean
Slate?
It? Oh, it's Slate. Yikes.
Yeah.
They don't allow any of their columnists to use that word?
They don't allow their sex columnists to use that word.
But they allow everyone else to?
I don't know. I didn't ask.
Oh my God.
All I knew was I got to figure out how to write about sex without using the word fuck. And I did it. And I do it over and over again every week. And I will until my contract expires. But like, that's probably because they have advertisers who have a problem with the word fuck. Like,
gotcha.
It's not Slate's fault. They're part of an ecosystem. And like, yeah. Johnson & Johnson doesn't want to be published next to the word fuck or similar. So there we have it. And a similar process takes place in all media outlets. And so we're just constantly, and this is where Foucault comes in, the discourse is in the absence of the discourse. By constantly talking about how we can't talk about sex, we're just making people obsessed with sex, but they don't even know what they're obsessed with, because it's really hard to find information unless you're going on Google looking for porn. You can find plenty of porn. You can't find that much like emotional sharing, although that is changing.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with that. And that is a bit of a theme we have in the show. Like, I don't know if you've come across like Justin Lee Miller's research on sexual fantasies. He has this book called Tell Me What You Want. I believe that's the title of it.
No.
So just to recap, it's going to be no surprise to Stoya. People's sexual fantasies turn out to be much kinkier and out there than I guess one might expect, you know, and things are just much more common. So, you know, this book was an attempt. I do recommend this book. I think it's a really good book. And kind of, he did this like very, very large scale study on the actual contents of people's fantasies. And that's one way, I guess, of normalizing a lot of these things. Do you think there's any like forms of sexual fantasies, like it's damaging, it's dangerous to normalize?
So one of the liberal feminist arguments is that by being permissive about the fantasy, we're shoring up the desire for the real thing.
Right.
I haven't seen any study that I think has good data on this. I will say in one of the Nordic countries, they allowed something, porn, prostitution, I'm not sure which, and the rate of sex crimes went down.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I wasn't there. You know, I want to see 5 studies that say that. I want to see 5 studies that ran for 10 years each that say that before I'm like, this is the truth. You know, but my gut says that fantasy is something that a lot of people don't want to make reality necessarily.
That's right.
And it's a harmless private thing that an individual can do alone or together with their partner. And as long as their partner's consenting, then who the fuck cares? But I'm like, look, man, stay away from kids.
Yeah.
Stay away from people who are incapable of consenting, i.e. the very mentally ill or the wasted. Don't fuck animals because they can't say no either. But like, other than that, if you're not hurting anyone, who cares? If you are hurting someone and they're a masochist and you're hurting them in exactly the way they asked for, who cares?
So, okay, well, what about, you said the vulnerable, like, I'm just trying to think on the spot here. There's the whole list of what counts as vulnerable. I mean, could someone make the argument that young girls that enter the field that are naive and some of them get exploited and that should
Here's
fall?
Here's my answer.
What's your answer to that?
One time I spoke at Barnard as part of Take Back the Night Week.
Okay.
I actually spoke there twice, but on one of those occasions, someone in the audience was like, what do you think about raising the age to enter porn to 21? And I was like, all right, how many people in this room are under the age of 21? And all these hands go up. And I'm like, all right, how many of you have made a huge life-affecting choice? Like signing up for a boatload of student loans and moving across the country to attend university. And all the hands stay up. And I'm like, do you see my point here? And they're like, yes. If we're allowed to take on crippling debt, someone else our age should be allowed to take on a crippling reputational job.
You've written about what we can learn about privacy from porn stars. Could you elaborate on what we can learn about? I mean, I think that ties into the reputational aspects.
I mean, I did in an essay for the New York Times, which was published in the opinion section. And if they don't want to go read it there, they can read it in my book, Philosophy, Pussycats, and Porn. Because I've already covered what we can learn about privacy from porn stars. It's really not that much. That headline was a bit clickbaity. But I mean, if you want to dig into the like having layers of names and how that connects to the real world, like I already wrote that and I love it. If you either paid with your eyeballs in traffic to the New York Times website or paid in dollars that eventually trickle partially into my pocket, because I've already done that thinking.
Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to say about the benefits, disadvantages of choosing a porn career?
I feel like I've done that at length as well. And anyone who thinks they're going to get in and have the career that I had is probably self-aggrandizing a bit because it takes a lot of dedication and a reaming ass ton of good luck. You can't use the career of someone who started over a decade ago as a template for a career in adult now. You're going to have to break your own ground. And other than that, like, good luck. Don't come back to me and tell me I told you it was a good idea.
Or me.
Yeah. I mean, if they want to go to you, that's not my problem. I'm not going to be reading the comments.
I'm not encouraging anyone.
You know, it's a high-risk industry. There's risk of sexually transmittable infection. There's risk of mechanical injury, and that's the goddamn right phrase for it. Mm. There's huge risk to your reputation. Like, you are going to have a hard time getting and keeping a job outside of porn once you've done it. But if you want to do it, then like, good luck.
All right.
Look me up when you've had a year's worth of seasoning.
Well, thanks for that advice. So you added this question that after we talked about the pitfalls of monogamy. So let's compare and contrast BDSM with monogamy. This will be a fun topic.
I was trying to distract you from the old thing that I'm bored of that I don't want to promote with this like other exciting question.
You should have just told me.
What's that other exciting question?
Well, the compare and contrast between BDSM and monogamy.
So a long time ago, someone asked me if I could compare and contrast BDSM and monogamy. And I was like, you know what? I will at some point. Today is that day. I have no way of contacting them to tell them their wish has finally been granted.
They might be listeners of the Psychotic.
Yeah, maybe they'll stumble across it. We'll retweet on the Stoya channels and maybe they'll see it.
Okay.
So in monogamy, you're saying, I like you so much that I want to belong to you, especially marriage. I like you so much that we're going to tie each other together in a way that's based on the conception of women as property. BDSM, you say, I like this person and I want to be yours for 1 hour. Or
maybe it's a whole relationship, right?
Or sometimes it's an entire 24/7 relationship, which is rare and not for the faint of heart. It's like definitely varsity level sexing. But you're saying we have this agreement and we belong to each other in very static prescribed roles. So BDSM and marriage, in both, you're signing up for a pretty dictated set of roles. And you can negotiate what those specific roles are. Like you can say like, hey, like I really want a 1950s style household. And you can go, that's cool, except I need to have a part-time job for myself to have essentially pin money as like a safety. And that's, I mean, someone about to get married or someone who's about to negotiate a BDSM relationship could want that specific thing.
So that's the compare part. What's the contrast part?
BDSM relationships don't go through the government. You don't have to have a license saying these people are doing things in the prescribed manner. And on the one hand, that's really great because who wants the government telling you how you can and can't have sex?
Right.
But on the other hand, like there's no recourse. There's no penalty. The only thing that happens to someone if they say ignore your safe word is maybe they get a reputation as a bad player in the community. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Whereas with a marriage, you divorce them.
Right.
There's a mediation. There's sometimes a financial penalty, especially in cases where there's no prenup and someone stepped out and cheated.
No, it's a very good point. It's a very good point. I recently saw an article making the case that BDSM should be thought of as a sexual orientation. I wanted to get your thoughts about that, about adding that to, you know, the category of sexual orientations.
I think poly versus open is definitely a Kinsey scale level thing. I think BDSM is far too broad of a category to be an oriented. Like, I'm oriented towards BDSM. What the ever-loving shit does that mean?
Right. And
like, yeah. I am a sadist. I'm a masochist. Absolutely. I'm into bondage. Absolutely. I'm submissive. I'm dominant. Absolutely. But BDSM is an oriented thing. Like, my fetish is eating pussy. Like, no. Come on.
Well, that's not BDSM. Obviously, right. I mean, I know that wasn't your point either, but maybe couldn't someone, you know, make the case that having some of these more submissive or dominant tendencies in bed itself are like a sexual orientation?
Yes. However, BDSM is too broad of a category.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So as I said, you can say I'm submissive as an orientation. You can say I'm dominant. I'm a masochist. I'm a sadist. I'm into bondage. All of these things are orientations, but BDSM is a category. That cannot be an orientation. Because that tells you nothing about the person other than they're a little bit kinky somehow.
Right. It'd be funny to like say kinky is a sexual orientation. That doesn't even make any sense.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't tell you anything. Therefore, it's a useless label.
Well, I'm going to send you this paper but you might...
I have 17 books I have to read. I don't know when I'm going to get around to this paper.
Well,
emails that sit for more than a month just get jettisoned into the abyss. It's really...
Fair enough. Okay, well, then maybe I won't even send it to you because I don't want to give you that pressure.
Give me in a month.
Okay, whenever you're interested in reading it, you let me know. Okay, so...
A year from now. Scott, do you remember an article about something? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, you won't.
Why won't I?
I know, maybe you will. maybe you have a mind like a steel trap instead of the steel colander that I have.
Oh, well, I wouldn't go that far. Okay, so something I know you're a big advocate of is sex worker rights. Sex worker rights are under attack these days, right? Could you talk a little about in what ways and what sort of advocacy work you've personally been doing?
I mean, I really wish everyone would stop trying to frame me as an activist. It does a disservice to dedicated activists. Like, I just do what I can when it's right in front of me.
But I said, okay, I said, in what ways do you advocate for? I mean, people can advocate without being, quote, an activist, right?
Right. So the second part of what I was going to say is I consider the word advocacy a bit too strong for my catch-as-catch-can style. Like, Audrey retweets the right things. But that's Audrey. Audrey's been given a directive to keep the lights on the Stoya Inc. Twitter page so I don't kill myself, because people tell me to kill myself online all the time. And there's only so much you can listen to that before you're like, actually, this would put an end to people telling me to kill myself. And then it starts to sound useful. So Audrey,
so substituting the word advocacy in my question for a word that where the question makes sense. Can you answer the question?
Well, there's no word that can make your question palatable to me, because I'm so tired of being called an activist, and advocacy is just too close. I can tell you that a number of states have started attempting to, and some have successfully, passed laws making it that much harder to get an abortion. That's a real problem. I can tell you that Trump is still president. A man who is proud of grabbing people by the pussy, direct quote. He's still in charge of the whole country. Things are grim. The only stuff I do is like when I'm called upon to speak for all sex workers, which is hella uncomfortable for me.
I bet.
I'll be like, yo, trans women of color dying in the street. Real problem here. All right, now let's try to promote my porn company that pays my bills, or that's trying to get to the point where it pays my bills and keeps the lights on. Yeah.
You really defy classification, don't you?
I do. People spend a lot of time trying to label me, and I resent it deeply.
You're very sensitive to words that could hint as though someone's trying to label you. Does this, I'm not going to start psychoanalyzing you, I promise, but does this relate to like just an overall sort of personality you have of being fiercely independent as a person? Is this like it's just a theme your whole life?
I have been described as fiercely independent. Most recently by the not boyfriend who asked me on the first date how I felt about kids. And I explained why I just didn't think I would be procreating with any American men or in America. And he was like, you're fiercely independent. And I'm like, why? And he's like, well, your entire stance presupposes that you don't have a partner you can count on. You don't have a community you can count on. And you don't have a social safety net you can count on. And I'm like, yeah, I'm an American woman.
I assume there wasn't a second date.
No, there was.
Oh, good. So you still have heated. What do you say?
He saw me.
Good, good. I'm trying to see you. I'm trying to see you too. I appreciate you as you are.
Yeah, it's the fiercely independent, definitely a running theme.
I mean, look, I resonate with that. I mean, just a moment of connection here. Like my whole early childhood, I was in special education and I hated labels and hated classifications. I had like an auditory thing. But so I grew up and developed this knee-jerk reaction to attempts to kind of put a label on me as well. So I get it. I empathize with it.
Is that part of why you went into psychology?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure. I wrote a book called Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, which was the story of my early educational experiences and why I was just like determined as a child to like make the education system a better place for quirky people, quirky kids.
That's really awesome.
Yeah, that's my like mission in life.
Nice.
Yeah. I will have to admit that this conversation in particular has been a little bit outside my comfort zone, but I'm going with it because I appreciate you. And
What have I done?
Oh, you haven't done anything. It's just in terms of outside of my knowledge base, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Like if we're talking about the science of intelligence or creativity, I'm on comfortable ground and I could start citing all sorts of things. But you're raising lots of intriguing, interesting points I haven't considered before. And on the spot, you know, I don't like claiming that I know the answer to anything without looking deeply into it. So thank you for stimulating in me ideas. I mean, it's funny saying that to a porn star. Thanks for stimulating me. But ideas. I'm talking about ideas.
Well, now I've got this weird thing for you.
Okay. What's that?
And I'm kind of putting the psychologist hat on your head. When I have to be creative in the sexuality space, I have to be aroused physically, not emotionally, intellectually, because, you know, women experience a lot of genital non-concordance. But my body has to be turned on.
That's so interesting. I mean, I think that links very much. I'm literally linking this to my research. This might be a stretch, but the connection between like safety, the need for safety, and kind of I'm really fascinated with this toggle between safety and exploration, and how, you know, when we feel like our environment isn't safe, or we feel like, I guess there could be situations like when you're not being turned on, you know, that maybe you're in a threatening environment. Maybe you're with, you're in a situation that, why would I want to explore with this person or in this environment? So I think that very much makes sense.
Sweet.
If that makes you feel any better.
This much less weird.
Well, you shouldn't feel weird.
It's about an inch less weird.
What? How many inches did it start with? Everything's relative.
Well, I feel like I've got like a foot and a half weird inside me. And right now I feel like I'm like, 17 inches weird.
Oh my gosh. This conversation is so different than like the 150 other episodes I've had on this show. And, you know, I'm wondering if my listeners are going to either have a all out revolt of my show, or actually maybe even respect. I hope they respect it more.
In the intro, like, yeah, make it clear,
I'm
like,
the story
is really odd. This went differently.
Well, I'm not going to frame that way, because I hate when people call me odd. I would never frame it that way.
I'm proud of how odd I am.
So, I mean, look, Phil, maybe I should have started off with kind of the context of how I know you, because people might be like, wait, what? How does Scott Berghoffman know Stoya? Like, I mean, suddenly, like, these worlds came together in a way that people might not make obvious sense. It's an IQ test. How did that go together? I went to your Sex Lit event in Brooklyn. I saw the advertisement. It looked so cool to kind of have highbrow intellectual discussions about novels and various books that have erotic content. And I found these discussions that I attended, went to a couple of these, really interesting, and really, I learned a lot. So I want to thank you for hosting that. So that's where I met you. Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thank you.
You added things to the discussion.
Oh, really? Did I?
Yep.
Yay. I'm just like really nerdy, and my friend Sky came with me, who's, you know, a good friend of mine. She was excited I was talking to you today, and she asked me a question. I said, do you have any questions for Stoya? And she asked me some questions. Do you mind if I ask you a Sky
ahead.
Question? Which author from any time through history would you like to go out partying with? And what would your drink of choice be for such an occasion?
Well, I would always choose Rakia. And if they don't have Rakia, then I want a Bellini. And if they don't have Bellini, then I don't care as long as it's got booze in it.
I love how you started on, you jumped on the drink part first.
I wanted to deal with the easy one first.
Yeah, actually that makes sense. Yeah.
I feel like Foucault.
You really like Foucault.
I really like Foucault. He contradicts himself all the time. He just forces people to deal with that, because sometimes life is contradictory and it's going to be fine. And I respect the hell out of that.
I agree 100% with what you just said. I don't agree 100% with all the things Foucault says. You probably don't agree 100% with what anyone says. Yeah, yeah. So that's a straw man. But
Stoya. I argue with everything.
Yeah. You do.
I do.
There's a term we have in the field called the highly sensitive person. It's like Elaine Aron has developed it, in like 15% of the human population scores high in the scale. I'm just curious, like, I gave you this scale, like how you would score on it.
Probably very high. Send me the scale. I'll do it. I'm curious.
No, I will send you the scale. But it combines, I think it's ultimately a gift. I mean, a big part of my research, and now to start talking about something that I feel a little more comfortable talking about, is like just the fact that people with all sorts of different learning disabilities and different ways of seeing the world, like viewing it through the giftedness lens, as opposed to the model we've operated in for the past like 100 years of education, which is like the deficit model. So I have
ADD. Which is attention deficit disorder. And I feel like the whole psychiatric community needs to understand that it is not a deficit of attention. In some ways, it can be harnessed, but mostly it's too much attention. Like, I'm trying to pay attention over here, but this buzzing noise is too loud. And so that's where my brain wants to go. And we just have, like, it's not just an ADD problem. Like, we have all this deficit language that keeps people from looking at their strengths.
So you asked for the highly person scale. I'll send that to you. Here's another thing I'd like to send you. Let me know if you want it. I wrote an article for Scientific American on why ADHD is a gift. I've been talking about the latest neuroscience of why we should think of it just as hyperactive imagination.
Yes.
Disorder as opposed to like a disorder of attention, like reframing it. So I think you might resonate with that. Do you mind if I send that to you?
I would love to read that.
Okay, great.
When I need to be creative, I can't take my Ritalin that day.
Yeah.
Like the sex advice column, I can sit down and bang it out. No big deal. But if I have to write some like personal essay, I can't take my Ritalin that day.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, you're going to resonate with this article. That's what it's all about, is the link between ADHD and creativity. When I say it's a gift, I mean for creativity.
I'm so excited.
And what we call in the field divergent thinking ability, which is that ability to kind of think of many possible uses for things or many possible...
That people call out of the box.
See, now I'm getting sensitive over because that phrase, I hate that phrase. Just as much as you hate the word advocacy.
It's just, you're using better words to describe the thing that people call...
That's right. That's right. Well, I've spent my whole career studying creativity and they have what's called a low latent inhibition. And I feel like that's what you have. And I feel like, okay, so most people, I'm just going to define it. In the biological world, like other animals, it's a preconscious gating mechanism. Like everything you see, is it relevant to my current goal or not? And humans have the remnants of that. We share it with other animals. So for so many years, having a high latent inhibition has been viewed as a universal good. Like it's good to filter out things that are irrelevant, you know, to your current goals, et cetera. But only in recent years have psychologists, myself included, started to study, well, can there be any benefits of having a reduced latent inhibition, kind of having a what's called a leaky filter? And psychologists are showing that there are a lot of benefits, it turns out, for creativity. They haven't been looking in the right places. Psychologists have been looking at like all these psychopathological outcomes as opposed to actual positive things like divergent thinking and creative achievement. And you find creative achievement in the arts in particular is wildly correlated with a reduced latent inhibition. It's related to ADHD as well, but again, it's how do we frame these issues, right?
This is really fascinating.
I'm glad this podcast took quite a turn, didn't it?
We swear it was like a roller coaster.
How do I tell listeners not to give up in the first 10 minutes in the sense that it'll smooth out? How do I tell them?
I think that's in the intro where you're like, look, Stoya
stick with it.
Argumentative, and sometimes actually regularly interviews get off to a bumpy start.
I feel like you started kind of like really defensive.
Yes.
And I feel your entire demeanor right now is completely different. And by the way, as you are, I'll take you as you are, right? So it's like, I want judging that beginning. I'm making an observation about, as an interviewer, you got to be open to whatever comes, right? So
I'm literally going to send this as like a press screening in the future. I can be like, oh, okay, here's a sample. Like, here's how you do it right.
Oh, thanks.
Yes, I am always this combative coming in. Like,
why is that? Is it like because you've been hardened in a sense? Like you've been asked so many annoying questions. I mean, is that why? I mean, I have no idea. You tell me why.
When I started performing in porn, journalists would sit down and start with sentences like, "How disappointed are your parents?" And like, the world has changed.
Yeah.
My career has evolved to the point where I have the kind of stature where they don't try that shit with me. But I've just been through too many interviews where the journalist was hostile, or they'd set me up for a gotcha moment, or I get into the studio show and they're like, ha, 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 we're going to play the Gail Dines clip. And I'm like, excuse me? You went to Gail, you didn't tell me you were going to Gail Dines. Like, how dare you? I don't want to be in the same show as Gail Dines. Like, that's how little time I have for her whole deal. And it's just, you learn through years of experience that journalists are probably not your friend. Mm. And you need to be a little spiky at the beginning to protect yourself.
I get that. You know, I totally get that. And you do see this with like academics who maybe their research is not politically correct that they study, and then they get on these like interviews and people constantly conflate, because you study this controversial topic, that means you advocate, you believe it. So like if you study intelligence differences, right, people mm-hmm. and you get on a show, it gets tiring after a while for people to call you a eugenicist. It's like, wait, no, I right, study okay. intelligence, but
this is nothing yeah. to do with eugenics.
Yeah. I study because I find it interesting and curious scientific question, and sometimes the truth isn't politically correct, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not my fault.
Oh god, like Yuval Noah Harari's research to Neanderthals,
yeah,
and like how like different populations have different percentages of not exactly sapiens DNA, and he's like, this like Nazis would have a field day with this, so it's really high octane to talk about.
Yeah Well, if I may use the word fuck Nazis. Not a fan.
Even Slate would be fine with that.
Yeah. So they'd allow that because it's, yeah. No. Absolutely. Well, look, I think I'll end this interview now unless there's anything else you wanted to talk about. Maybe someday, Stoya, maybe we could have a part two where we just nerd out over like areas of mutual sort of science. You know what I mean? Like something
yes.
like, yeah. Okay. Let's do that.
I know. What if we flip the script and I ask you, oh my gosh, I wish I had a psychologist's opinion.
Yeah, let's do that.
Awesome.
And I'll tell you why I want to do that. So I've long been asked by listeners of the Psychology Podcast, when are you going to be interviewed? What about you? So maybe you'd be the perfect person to do that. So
maybe I'll have to do research.
Uh-oh. I don't really have, like, I'm trying to think, my most controversial thing may be the time that Charlie Sheen yelled at me from the stage of Radio City Music Hall. I think that's my most controversial thing that you'd find if you Googled me on YouTube.
Why did Charlie Sheen yell at you?
Well, I was doing
Charlie Sheen.
Well, he was during his meltdown, you know, era. And I was doing a cover story for Psychology Today on how to spot a narcissist. And I was supposed to interview him that night, and he had my business card, and I went to a show, and right after the break, he sits there and he pulls out my business card and he reads, he says, "Fuck Scott Barry Kaufman, PhD, NYU. He thinks I'm bipolar, but we all know I'm bi-winning." He just went on this curse-filled tirade against me as I'm sitting here in the audience, just like, yeah, that's me he's talking about.
Oh god,
it's on YouTube. But anyway, it was so awkward. I wasn't gonna like pathologize you. I really wasn't just wanted to have a conversation with you. But anyway, that was nuts. So but I was just trying to think of like what would be the most controversial thing. Okay, so anyway, sounds good. Maybe we'll do a part two sometime. And also, I feel like somehow it was fitting that there was this buzzing sound, which, by the way, seems less right now. Does it seem less to you too? Yeah. Do you think the buzzing sound like somehow attract your mood during this interview?
I was just wondering, would it sound psychotic to say perhaps?
I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, isn't that crazy how that happened?
Yeah, it is crazy.
Wow. I need to think about the metaphysics of that, because I don't know if we can explain that scientifically, but I do feel like it was, you know, like a mood ring of some sort. Do you know what I mean? Like,
the grumpier I got, the louder it got. And then when I started to calm down, it disappeared.
I'm not going to frame this as like you grumpy issue, because that's not really totally fair to you, but I would frame it as a sort of tension between us, sort of, you know what I mean by tension? Just me trying to like figure out what direction am I going to take that on the spot, you know, sort of thing. And then we got more in flow. That's how I'm going to frame it, you know? And and I feel like once flow happened, I feel like that noise went away. So anyway, I'm just going to put this up as it is. And I guess apologize to people for the sound, but it does somehow feel fitting, doesn't it? All right. Thanks, Stoya, for being on the Psychology Podcast and chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me. I apologize for being mildly nightmarish at the beginning.
No, you're awesome.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.